Quantum Computing and associate faculty here at Perimeter. My undergrad studies were in mathematics, and then I got into cryptography, which when I was in England doing my graduate studies lured me into quantum algorithms. Because quantum algorithms were breaking the crypto I was trying to break with classical algorithms. So I eventually realized this was the right paradigm in which to be doing cryptography for the future. And in recent years, it's become very relevant. Actually, there's important policy decisions that have to be made so that as we continue to build large-scale quantum computers, we'll be able to enjoy their benefits without having to suffer all the consequences to our information and communications infrastructure. So my work for my grad studies was essentially all in quantum algorithms and complexity. So I've been working in the field for a long time. This will be an introduction. I'm trying to balance, just giving an executive summary of what quantum algorithms can do and actually teach you a little bit about how they work. I don't know what your preference is, but I'm trying to do a bit of both. I don't want to do just an executive summary where you have no clue, no hands-on experience with an algorithm. But as you'll see, even going through two algorithms will easily eat up a whole hour and a half. So I will, near the end, start kind of summarizing how what the bottom line is. I won't have the time. I mean, there's an entire course by Ashwin Nayak at the University of Waterloo on quantum algorithms, and even that isn't covering everything. So obviously, I can't teach you all the, can't make you experts in quantum algorithms in one or two lectures. So I'll get as far as I can today in this. I can do a little more on Thursday. And on Thursday, I was going to maybe give a summary of cryptography in a quantum context, what that looks like. Okay. So feel free to interrupt, of course. There's obviously a chalkboard where I can elaborate on things. So in one line, quantum algorithmics is about choreographing constructive interference on the outcomes you want and destructive interference on the undesirable outcomes, which is easier said than done, because you're heavily constrained by the laws of quantum physics, unitarity, for example. So more concretely, we've had randomized algorithms are a standard part of conventional computer science. You might start with just an oversimplified version of a randomized algorithm. One system in the state 0, 0, through some random process, it evolves into one of the four bit strings, right, with probability P00, et cetera, P03, which means you go from 0 encoded in binary to 3 encoded in binary with probability P03. And then you have some other random process, which, from each of these four states, you could end up in any of the four states with some probability Qij. And if you want to compute the probability of ending up in 0, 0, physicists know how to do this. You sum over all the paths that get you there, the probability of those paths. So you sum over all the intermediate points j, the paths that take you from 0 to j, and then from j back to 0. Now, suppose we looked at the same process quantum mechanically, and there was a unitary evolution to a superposition of these four states, but then they were measured, right? And they collapse, or however you want to term it, to one of these four states with probability equal to the amplitude squared. So in this case, A03 would have squared is the Q03 from the last slide, and so on. This is the same evolution, except realizing that in this case, for example, there was a quantum evolution, and there were measurements at each stage that led to those probabilities. Okay, so same thing, it's those amplitudes squared. Now, if we don't do those intermediate measurements, and we just let it evolve freely, and only measure at the end, well, then we have a slightly different formula, right? You have to sum over all the amplitudes. The amplitudes of going from 0 to 0 through the intermediate points j, you sum over all the paths, and then that's the amplitude, and you take the absolute value squared, right? This is all very, very basic quantum mechanics. And the point is, as you know, sometimes these numbers, if the absolute value signs are outside, it becomes bigger, or sometimes if they go inside the summation, the number's bigger. It's a very different distribution, as you see in the two-slit experiment, for example. So this is what we try to achieve with quantum algorithms, is choreograph this kind of interference so that in the quantum case, we get a pattern we just don't know how to efficiently construct with a classical computer. Of course, with 2 bits, everything's easy. So we're really looking at dozens, hundreds, thousands of bits and getting interference patterns we simply don't know how to simulate with a classical device. So generally speaking, you know, how do we try to come up with quantum algorithms? So often, you know, we're analyzing some sort of classical function. Okay? So imagine there's a classical function f that maps n-bit strings to some finite set t, and it runs in polynomial time, right? So it runs in time that's a polynomial in n. As n gets bigger, it'll get more complex, but it's only polynomial, say. You can prepare a superposition of x's and then compute f at x in the second register of qubits and get a superposition like this. And you only have to, the amazing thing is you only have to implement f once. So to some people this seems magical. You've done exponential amount of work in one shot and so on. Well, yes and no. There's no free lunch here. You know, if you just, is this really exponentially many computations at polynomial cost? Not exactly, okay? Because say you just measure this system, you're only ever going to get one x and one f at x. Okay? So that's it, and you're done, right? So that's a heck of a lot less than you could get with exponential number of computations, in a classical setting. So there's no quantum advantage here. So what you really want to do is through a state like that, observe it, measure it in a different way so that you can learn some global property of f, okay, without learning any specific points. There's a trade-off here. If you want to learn the global properties, you can't learn the local properties. Okay, it's a sort of uncertainty principle here. But it's just not easy. You can't just articulate your favorite global property and presto, there's a quantum algorithm that gives it to you. No, it's actually pretty hard to design an algorithm that gives you that global property. But we know there's basic information theoretic constraints where we can't get more than n bits of information from an n-bit register. So there are limits, and we're not going to be able to, I sometimes call it, you can see the forest without seeing the trees. But you have to very carefully engineer those things. So you need, quantum parallelism is great, but it's not enough. You also need some sort of quantum interference. Even that's not enough. But these are necessary but not sufficient elements of a powerful quantum algorithm. So for example, if there's no entanglement at all, if it's a pure state algorithm with no entanglement, then you can simulate it, even if there's parallelism and interference. In designing quantum algorithms and trying to find problems where quantum computers help, we often work in the query scenario, which has its limitations. We're aware of them, but it's a very powerful methodology for learning non-trivial things about the power of quantum computers. And sometimes they lead to very practical applications. So imagine, this is classical now. You have a black box that takes input strings x and outputs f at x. But you don't get the source code for f. You can just evaluate it. Or if you do get it, you just don't look at it. And you want to determine some property of f using as few queries to it as possible. Okay. You do need other operations typically to prepare and post-process, but in the query model, we often ignore those things, at least temporarily. So polynomial interpolation is one simple example, right? There's f at x is a polynomial of degree d. You want to determine all the coefficients. So classically, you have to query d plus 1 times, and that'll let you determine the coefficients, right? And determine f. So the global property here is determining all the coefficients of f, for example. But you don't get to see f. You need the source code for f. All you need is the output of f on d plus 1 distinct inputs. David Deutsch, in the early 80s, posed a problem where he was able to find a quantum advantage in solving it. It's a simple question where f is just a function that maps 0 or 1 to 0 or 1. So there's only four possible functions. The function that always outputs 0, the function that always outputs 1, these are the trivial functions, the constant functions, the identity function, and the not function, the function that outputs the opposite. So, and he said, suppose you just wanted to know whether it was constant or not. Right? Or in other words, determine the exclusive OR. This is the sum modulo 2. So f at 0 plus f at 1 is 0 if f is constant, and 1 if f is not constant. Now, any classical algorithm has to query twice. Because just knowing f at 0, you know absolutely nothing about what f at 1 is, and vice versa. So it's easy to see you need two queries. But what about on a quantum computer? So in a quantum setting, as I think Richard taught you, we typically focus in the unitary sort of reversible model. So you have a reversible way of implementing the function. You have input A, you have workspace initialized to B, A and B are bits, 0 or 1, and you output, you XOR, you add F at A modulo 2 to the output register. Okay. So classically, you have to query twice. So you compute F at 0 here, you flip the input bit with the X gate, so now it's 1, and then you add 1 to F at 1 to F at 0, and you compute F at 0 XOR, sum modulo 2 F at 1, and you get the answer. This is just classically query both bits and add up the answers. So here's an algorithm, quantum algorithm, that does it in one shot. So I believe Richard would have defined the Hadamard transformation for you at the last class. Right? So how does this algorithm work? So first of all, on the output register, what if we just put 0 minus 1? So instead of the output of f being added to a 0 or 1, what happens if we add it to 0 minus 1? So 0 minus 1 is an eigenstate of whatever it is we're going to do. Because we're either going to do nothing, so 0 minus 1 goes to 0 minus 1 with eigenvalue plus 1, or we flip the bits. So 0 minus 1 goes to 1 minus 0, which is just minus, in bracket, 0 minus 1. So it's an eigenstate with eigenvalue minus 1 if the input register, if f at 0 is 1, if f at x is 1, an eigenvalue plus 1 if f at x is 0. So what does that mean? So let's just repeat, go over what I just said, but in a different notation. So x is either 0 or 1, right? And if f at x is 0, x just stays, we don't pick up, 0 minus 1 goes to 0 minus 1. This is a part that often, it's simple. And I'm dropping normalization factors. So it equals right. So if f at x is 0, literally nothing happens. But if it's 1, we typically associate, we think of the minus sign as being associated with the second register. But we can just as well associate it with the first register. So it's the same thing. It's a scalar, so you can associate it with the first state just as well. There's no physics here. It's just mathematics. And grade 9, you like to collect your like terms, so it's nice for the second register to be the same in both situations. So the second register, we're just going to treat as 0 minus 1, and then all the variations will stick into the first register. So this is if f at x is 1. So this is a 1, a minus 1 if f at x is 1, and a plus 1 if f at x is 0. Okay, in other words, minus 1 to the f at x. So when you, by putting 0 minus 1 in the second register, which is an eigenstate, which seems like, well, that's going to be pointless. See, I can see it's not going to change. It's not going to change, but it's going to induce a phase shift that depends on the answer f at x. Please interrupt me if anything. This is super simple, and once you get it, you think, well, why did he spend so much time on it? But if I go too fast, then I always end up getting a lot of students come up afterwards. And okay, good. So if instead of 0 or 1, you prepare 0 plus 1, then the 0 picks up the minus 1 to the f at 0 phase factor, and the 1 picks up the minus 1 to the f at 1 phase factor. So that means the first register is now, right, if it's constant, if f at 0 equals f at 1, I don't care what it is, then there's no relative phase shift between 0 and 1. This is either plus or minus 0 plus 1. And the plus or minus just depends on what f at 0 is. But if f at 0 is different from f at 1, now there's a relative phase shift between 0 and 1. And it's either 0 minus 1 or 1 minus 0. I don't care. It's either plus or minus 0 minus 1. So that first register now has the answer. If it's 0 plus 1, we know the function was constant. If it's 0 minus 1, we know the function wasn't constant. And so a simple Hadamard transformation on the first bit, right? The definition of Hadamard gate is it maps 0 to 0 plus 1 and 1 to 0 minus 1. It's self-inverse. So it maps 0 plus 1 to 0, 0 minus 1 to 1. So the definition of Hadamard is that one qubit gate that decodes 0 plus or minus 1 into the computational basis. So then we do the Hadamard gate and we measure and we get the answer in one shot. Do we know what f at 0 is? Yes?
It's kind of like not exactly related, but has anyone ever tried to like automate the design of these algorithms?
Yes.
Is that what you want? Or did people do that? Like,
no, for small cases.
It just seems like maybe actually coming up with like quorum algorithms for like larger problems would be like a really, really difficult task, and that there might be automating it.
There are attempts at you know brute force optimizing to find out what is the minimum query algorithm or whatever cost you give it. So we have, for example, in a very related task is compiling. You give me a unitary and compile it down to the gates that you're given. Mm-hmm. And we've done that by naive brute force methods. And then we discovered optimizations. And then we tried to understand why. And then we came up with a theory that was more generally applicable. So automation has helped in some cases. The problem is, brute force scales, exponentially badly here. So we've had algorithms where we could do 4, maybe 5, but 6, we just, even with the blue gene Q, we didn't think we could do it. But sometimes 4 or 5 bits is enough to get some insights. Sometimes 4 bits is already better than nothing. When you're compiling your quantum algorithm, shaving off 20% on some 4-qubit piece that you use a lot is worthwhile. But if you want to be more ambitious and gain some deep insights, sometimes you get lucky too. And you see something, an optimization you hadn't seen before. You try to understand if there's a deeper method there. People have tried genetic algorithms and other heuristics as well to automate this sort of thing. But, back in the early 80s, there was no one had thought of it, no one even defined a quantum computer. Deutsch and Feynman, and just a handful of people even cared, right? But now we're at a point where there is a bit of work, and I think that's a growing field, this whole quantum software. Actually, IBM just announced that they're going to start selling services, I believe, both to their 5-qubit physical device and their simulator. My colleague, Vlad Georgiou, he's also put his simulator online for a couple years now, I think, at least a year. I think he can do up to 25-qubit. really nice, you know, he's got an API. He could do QDITS as well. Microsoft has a nice suite of software tools. I think this is starting to grow. We're close enough to the hardware where a few forward-thinking groups are thinking, oh, this might actually be an interesting place to explore. 10 years ago, it just seemed a bit insane to be worried about software tools for a device that was nowhere close to. But now I personally think we're getting close, so I'm interested in these, personally interested in these software tools. And in fact, in 97, we implemented this and published it in 98, the implementation of the Deutsch algorithm using liquid state and MR. Now, you can, Deutsch moved back to England, was at Oxford, collaborating with Richard Joza, who was a student at Oxford, with I believe Roger Penrose at the time. They generalized this. I won't go through this. I mean, it's in our textbook, and I'll just. The bottom line is, if you have n, let's say f maps n bits to one bit, and I promise you, it's either constant or evenly split. Again, most functions don't have that property. But if I promise you f is either constant or has just as many zeros as ones, to determine that deterministically, classically, you need exponentially many queries. But quantumly, the same algorithm, and this is sort of a modified version of the original algorithms. The original algorithms worked with an error probability. Still did something that wasn't possible classically, but we were able to make some minor adjustments to these algorithms and get them to work error-free with just one query. They could get theirs error-free with two queries, but so the algorithm is essentially the same. I won't walk through it because it'll take a lot of time.
Another question.
Yeah.
So I don't quite see why the cost bookends you would need that many queries
online. If you want no errors. So you could always, there's always a chance.
But it's not that small, right? Like if you are really promised that it's either constant or
so,
balanced,
okay.
Then
so there's,
in many cases it might suffice to check two, three.
Yeah, this is worst case complexity.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so worst case complexity, zero error, it's this. But you're totally right. In practice, if I just wanted epsilon, I had an error tolerance of epsilon. How many times would I have to query, roughly? On the order of log 1 over epsilon. So it does get, it scales as epsilon grows. Not a lot, it's not bad. I'll take log 1 over epsilon any day, or most days. But quantum, it's 1. So, this was for dramatic effect, and I'm not spending too much time on it, because you're right. if you only want bounded error correctness, there's no dependency on n anymore. The dependency is just on your error tolerance. And it's good dependency. It's log 1 over epsilon. But still, quantumly, it's constant. So the really interesting, and there was another example by Bernstein and Vazirani, which is a precursor to Simon. I just don't have a lot of time in this lecture to take you through every single step of the way. So again, our textbook does explain these intermediate algorithms. Let me quickly sketch how Simon's algorithm works. So it's an example where classically you need exponentially many queries, even for a probabilistic outcome, and quantumly you just need n queries. So Dan Simon was a postdoc at the University of Montreal with Gilles Brossard in the early 90s. He's at Microsoft now. Let f be, take n bits to n bits, and it has this arbitrary property, let's say, that there's some n-bit string r, such that f at x equals f at y, if and only if x and y differ by r. Okay, so it's a 2-to-1 function. So there's two inputs for every output that actually happens in the range, there's two inputs that go to it. But it's not two random inputs. They pair up. X, XOR r gives you y. And y, XOR r gives you x. Okay, so they differ by some fixed pattern, non-zero pattern, r. R can't be the L0 string. So for example, f at x, say f at 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, and f at 1, 0, 1 is 0, 0, 1. So what's the pattern here? What's the r here? So it's 2 to 1. Every half, there's only half of the 3-bit strings are in the range, but they each occur twice. And so what's that hidden mask here?
One zero one, right? So
111 goes to 000. If you add 101 to this, you get 010, which goes to the same thing. So that's the hidden mask. And the problem is, if you just randomly pick an X, you know, you're not going to get 000, right? you're not going to be able to pick, sorry, doesn't matter which one. You're not going to be able to pick what you measure. You just have to keep sampling until you get the same thing twice, classically. Yeah. So that works. Just continuing to sample until you get the same thing twice. Familiar with the birthday paradox, it takes square root of 2 to the n, say on the order of square root 2 to the n samples to succeed with constant probability. You can always get lucky, but if you want your probability of success to be bounded below by a constant, a non-zero constant, you need exponentially, you know, square root 2 to the n queries. This doesn't mean there isn't a more clever algorithm, except there isn't, okay? There's a proof that says you can't do better than this naive, just brute force sampling, classically. So what does Dan do? So again, we're given an oracle that implements f at x reversibly. So for an n-bit string x1, x2, up to xn, it XORs the answer onto an n-bit string y1, y2, up to yn. So the obvious thing, you know, every other quantum algorithm we'd seen before that looked like prepare uniform superposition of all the inputs and prepare that superposition over x, f at x state. Okay, so Dan did the same thing. Okay. And we know it's 2 to 1. So we can rewrite this, right? Over all x in some set, let's call it T, right? And then we have I'm going to drop normalizations or not worry too much about them. X plus 1 over root 2. Sorry, you guys can't see it. Okay. So we sum over, let's just pair them up, right? And T is just a set of, you know, half, which just picks one representative from each of these pre-images, okay? So for each f at x that actually occurs, there's two pre-images. So there's two states. The first register is in a superposition of two strings, x and x plus r, because f at x plus r is the same thing. Okay. Now, Dan, like many of the early authors, they just said, oh, now imagine you measure the second register. You can actually skip this step because they measure it and they never look at it. So really they just trace it out. They just ignore it. But let's just say they measure. So with probability 1 over 2 to the n minus 1, they get, you know, some random state of this form. Sorry. You want R, right? That's the problem, to find R. You kind of feel, you can almost taste it, except how do you get R from that superposition? So if you measure, you just get X, or you get X plus R. And what's wrong with just running this whole algorithm again and trying to get the other?
You're not going to get the same X.
Yeah, right. Like, the only way you'd get the same X plus X plus R is if you got the same F at X. And that's just the classical algorithm, which has exponential complexity. So if you could get the same F at X twice, well, you could solve it classically anyway. So that's not going to work. So, not surprisingly, the answer is you apply the Hadamard transformation to those n-bit strings. Okay. Did Richard explain what that does on n different qubits? I'll just give you the punchline because it's easy to verify that x goes to, you know, so 1 over root 2x goes to the sum over all n-bit strings y. There's a fate, it's all plus or minus ones. It's a dot product of x and y that determines the phase of y. And it's a dot product of x and x or s dot y. Okay. Sorry, that's the amplitude of y. Okay. So that's sorry, let me do that better. And in this other string, it's x, x over s, dot y. Okay. So, which y's survive? So minus 1 to the x dot y, right? Just the, you know, x1, y1 times x1, y2 all reduce modulo 2 because you're taking minus 1 to the power of it. You can factor out x dot y, and it essentially works out to minus 1 to the s dot y. So which y's survive? Which y's occur with non-zero probability?
Did you change R to S?
Yes. In my textbook, I call this S, so I keep going on. Yeah, thanks. So which y's survive here? Will occur with non-zero probability? So if it's 0, 1 plus 1, it survives. If it's 1 minus 1, you'll never see it. Its amplitude is 0. So in order for this to be a plus 1 and not a minus 1, you need r dot y. You need r dot y. Right? Okay. So this is all modulo 2. So the only y's we ever see are the y's orthogonal to R. R is a secret. That's the thing which we want to discover. Simon's algorithm doesn't tell us y directly. Instead, it gives us things orthogonal to y. That's pretty good, okay? As long as there's no errors, if you sprinkle some errors into this, you kind of mess everything up. But if there's no errors, you sample one string that's orthogonal to y, so R, Y1 is orthogonal to R, Y2 is orthogonal to R, and so on. So you build up a linear system, right? Once you have N plus a constant number of such equations, right? You're likely to have a unique solution to the linear system. And you just do whatever linear equation solver you like, Gaussian elimination or anything more efficient, and you solve it. So That's why Dan Simon's algorithm needs, on the order of n, actually n plus O of 1, n plus a few, to be able to solve this linear system and determine R. So that's an exponential speed up in terms of queries. And very nicely, with Dan's algorithm, the non-query part of the algorithm is also efficient. So it's not like there's polynomial many queries, but then there's this exponentially nasty post-processing. It's actually really easy. Yes.
What if you have a periodicity which is not just two, you don't get just two elements in your in the size of your.
Yeah. So you're saying, what if we change the problem and it's not 2 to 1, but it's 4 to 1 or 8 to 1? And so, in fact, that is a generalization of Simon's problem in a very natural way, where the function is constant on some subgroup. This is a subgroup, in a sense, of order 2. We could think of a subgroup of order 2 to the k or whatever. The same algorithm works and finds you generators for that subgroup. Yeah.
I thought this was like a periodicity problem.
Yeah. It is a periodicity problem in a general sense, but the period is, in a sense, really a hidden subgroup. It's not necessarily just a one-dimensional or... So quantumly, order n queries, and it's only polynomially many. I don't even think you need the n cubed, but you need polynomially many classical algorithms or other non-query. Okay.
Could you explain the notation, the omega and omega?
Yeah. So these are notations from mathematics, and it's also used in computer science a lot. I think physics uses it more and more. So we say a function is in big O, you know, of g of n. So g of n is a function. F is in big O of g of n if there exists an n naught and some, it's an, you know, positive integer n naught, some constant bigger than 0, such that f at n is less than or equal to c g at n for all n bigger than or equal to n naught. So asymptotically, f is essentially on the order of g, or at most. It could be a lot less, but it's less than or equal to some constant times g eventually. Okay. That's what omega, big O, means. My chalkboard strategy isn't optimal. So that means f is upper bounded by g, essentially. We say f is in omega of g of n if there exists an n naught, some positive constant c, such that f at n is bigger than or equal to that constant g at n for all n bigger than or equal to n naught. Okay. Anyway, that just defines these notations. There's also a little o of n and a little omega, which means it's asymptotically goes to zero. The rate here, you can also say, you know, f at n over g at n is less than a constant. If it goes to zero, then we say little o of g. And similarly, omega means it's asymptotically actually strictly greater than g. Those ratios are bound, or, you know, go to infinity. Okay. So to recap, I used the fact that if you take an n-bit string, x1 up to xn, you bitwise send each one through. This is not entangling. It looks like it might be, but it isn't. These are just separate Hadamard gates. You get a superposition of all the n-bit strings. So this tensor product of 0 plus and minus 1, 0 plus and minus 1, if you work it out, the n-bit string y, y1, y2 up to yn, has an amplitude which is minus 1 to the x dot y. So since this is self-inverse, it means if somebody were to hand you this state and say, what is x? If you just measured it, you would get garbage. You'd get random strings. But the Hadamard transformation is a way of decoding information that's encoded in the phases and presenting it in the amplitude, something measurable, something you can measure in the computational basis. So when I say measurable, I mean in the computational basis. So of course, it's measurable here too, in a strict sense. You could define your projective measurement so to spit out the answer. But when we say measure, we're thinking physically. We're assuming we have some means for measuring in some basis that we call the computational basis, and we want to, in practice, implement the measurement. And we're assuming that the only measurement we know how to do, we have equipment for, is a measurement in the computational basis. So you take something which, if you measure in the computational basis, you get random bits, but you extract the x into something that can be seen in the computational basis. So these algorithms have a certain form, which says we take some classical function, we implement them in a superposition, and somehow information gets encoded in phases. And measuring, so measuring the states wouldn't give much information. But then there's a simple transformation that extracts the information. So imagine, sorry, this got mangled. But imagine there's some number omega between 0 and 1 that's encoded in a state like this. It's in a superposition of n-bit strings that encode the integers 0 to 2 to the n minus 1. And the amplitude of y, the integer y now, so instead, don't think of these, I mean, physically they're bit strings, but logically we treat them as integers. The phase of y is e to the 2 pi I omega times y. Again, in binary, we can expand omega to be 0, point, x1, x2, and so on, where the x's are bits. 2x is just omega shifted to the left by 1, and so on. 2 to the n minus 1 omega, sorry, 2 omega is just this string shifted by 1, and 2 to the n minus 1 omega shifts it by n minus 1. Remember, e to the 2 pi I is 1, so e to the 2 pi I times any integer is 1. So when we take e to the 2 pi I to omega, the x1 part essentially vanishes. It's not there anymore. And if you shift by 2 to the k, we essentially delete the first k minus 1, first k bits. And now the high order bit is k minus xk minus 1. You'll see in it very shortly why we care. Let's take a simple example. Omega is either a half or 0. So it's point x1, and x1 could be 0 or 1. Notice that e to the 2 pi I times point x1, e to the pi I is minus 1. Right? So this is either minus 1 to the x1, well, it's minus 1 to the x1. So it's either plus or minus 1, depending on what x1 is. And if I give you this simple state, the Hadamard gate is what decodes. You know, if x1 is 0, the Hadamard output 0. If x1 is 1, the Hadamard gate output's 1. So it's your Fourier transform, your transformation that extracts that phase information. Now, it's actually an exercise to show that if you treat the string y1, y2 as a bit string in binary, this superposition breaks up into a tensor. This is not entangled. It's a tensor product. Right. Where at the left, we have sort of omega shifted. We have the low order bits of omega are prominent, and then slightly less low order. And at the very end, we just have e to the 2 pi I omega, where the leading bit is the high order bit of omega. So if somebody hands you that state above, they've really handed you a tensor product, where this state encodes, the rightmost bit encodes omega, the next bit 2 omega, 4 omega, and so on. Like I said before, these shifted versions have just deleted the higher order bits. So you can more, the lower order bits are more significant now. You'll see what where we're heading now. So imagine an omega, it's not so nice, it's not 0 or a half, it's 0, a quarter, a half, or 3/4. Okay? So it's 2 bits, or the rest of the bits are all zeros. Now, I can take that shifted version, I can take the 2 omega version of that bit, where 2 omega is encoded, and I use that, so now it's just x2, and the Hadamard gate tells me what x2 is. Now that I know what x2 is, I can effectively erase it here. Because I really wish that x2 weren't there, right? Because then I could just do a Hadamard gate and extract x1. But because there is no x3, x4, the Hadamard gate tells me what this Hadamard gate up there tells me what x2 is. And now that I know it, by conditional rotation, I erase x2. So if x2, this says if x2 is 1, rotate, do a phase shift of minus 0.01. And if x2 is 0, don't do anything. Okay. So here's a 2-qubit circuit that takes omega encoded in the phases and extracts it. Extracts both bits of omega exactly, and so on. So if let's say it's just, if I know it's an integer over 8, then I just need these 3 qubits. Suffice, extend this circuit, I get x3, I get x2. Now that I know these 2 bits, I can erase them, and so on. And you can extend this naturally to n bits. So what this does, if you look at what this transformation is, it takes superpositions of this form, where the phase in front of y is e to the 2 pi I x over 2 to the n times y, and it extracts x. This may look familiar. It's the inverse of this operation, right? Remember, these superpositions are just vectors. That was the inverse of the discrete Fourier transform. So the quantum Fourier transform is just the discrete Fourier transform embodied in n qubits. So the magic is, classically, you have to write a string of a list of 2 to the n numbers. Here, we're somehow embodying it in just log 2 to the n, and just n quantum bits. So there is potentially an exponential efficiency to be gained here. And the QFT just somehow physically embodies this discrete Fourier transform. Okay. Physically, you're just mapping these n, the QFT, we don't mean quantum field theory, quantum Fourier transform, we map this n-bit string to this n-bit superposition in such a way that the state vectors have the discrete Fourier transform affected on them. But it's really cheap. Log base 2 of n, capital N, operations, squared operations, versus classically having to write down the whole thing of length n, capital N. So when I was saying n before, I meant little n, but which is log base 2 of capital N. So this phase extraction circuit was just a way of rediscovering the quantum Fourier transform, the inverse of it. Now let's suppose, in real life, omega is not usually an integer over 2 to the n, okay? So what does it map? What does that same circuit map this n-bit string to, where omega isn't restricted to those just 2 to the nth roots of unity? Well, it has to map to something. It's a continuous map. So it's not too surprising that if omega is really, really close to a power, an integer over 2 to the n, you're likely to measure that integer, right? By continuity arguments, there should be a small enough epsilon such that epsilon deviation is still going to leave you within delta of that. But we, this is all can be made rigorous. So it maps you to something, which I call omega tilde, which is just a good estimator for omega. It's a superposition, so omega tilde is just a superposition of n-bit strings. That's just a tautology. Well, that's all it can be, because it's in that Hilbert space, that state space. But the amplitudes are very focused, are very close to the integers y, such that y over n is close to omega. In fact, the chance of it being one of the two closest values of omega so omega is here. There's some, you know, y over n, some y minus 1 over n, and so on, you know, 1 over n. It's somewhere. It's not promising to be nice, so it's not necessarily going to be some integer over your capital N, where capital N is 2 to little n. But it's somewhere. So it's in between. It's in between two of these. The chance of getting one of the two closest ones is at least 8 over pi squared. Okay, so that's pretty good. And the probability tapers off inverse quadratically, basically. So your alpha y, the amplitude of alpha y, is inversely proportional to the distance. So the, you know, your amplitude of measuring this state over here, you know, y plus 20 over n, right, is inversely proportional to, you know, 20 over n. And of course you square amplitude, so it tapers off reasonably, not exponentially, but pretty quickly. So if you're happy with a constant probability of getting something really close, you have it. And this is really just the analysis of the discrete Fourier transform. So for any real omega, if you give me that superposition of e to the 2 pi I x, y, omega y over 2 to the n as your coefficient of y, so in this case, let n, little n be 3. If you give me these three states, you get a really good, you know, with high probability, you're going to get very close. You're going to be within 1 over 8 of omega. And in general, it'll be within 1 over 2 to the n of omega if you have an n-bit estimator. Now, this is a really useful tool. Okay, I haven't done anything interesting with it yet, but it's a very powerful tool. And this is, you know, a trick that, you know, Kataev showed in his, you know, paper in the, you know, 96 or so, right? The one we've already gone over. If you have a function, a Boolean function, if in the target register, you know, this control, this is the same thing as the big box with UF, you know, it looks at the input on the first bit and adds f at x mod 2 to the second bit. And if you put 0 minus 1 there, the 0 minus 1 is sort of just a catalyst, in a sense, that lets you encode f at x into the phase factor of the first qubit, or the first register. Could be several qubits. Right. This is what we went through already. So imagine, more generally, there's some unitary u which has an eigenvalue that isn't just plus or minus 1, could be anything, any phase factor, and I give you an eigenvector psi. And let's do a controlled u. So if the top bit is 1, you apply u. If the top bit is 0, you don't. You apply the identity. So similarly, you know, if you apply u, you get the eigenvalue e to the 2 pi I, and you can effectively kick it back to the first register. Like we did earlier in the class. And if it's 0, you don't apply u, so essentially you do the identity, so nothing happens. So if you, instead of having the control be 0 or 1, you make it a superposition, then that eigenvalue becomes a relative phase. If you put an eigenstate in the first bit, then it's just a global phase, you can never measure it. By making it a controlled u and having the control bit be both on and off, it now becomes a relative phase, which is physically observable. So he's following Kataev's game here. He wants to estimate eigenvalues of unitaries. So he turns those eigenvalues into relative phases on a control bit. Because the eigenvalue vectors, who knows what they are, but he manages to kick them back into this control register where we can now manipulate them. Interestingly, you know, it's convenient to have higher order powers of omega. It lets us get to the low order bits of omega faster, potentially. So just instead of applying u once, apply it x times. If you apply it x times, you get e to the 2 pi omega again and again and again x times, multiplied together, so you get omega x as your phase parameter. Okay. And if you make it a relative phase, now you have a relative phase of not just e to the 2 pi omega, but e to the 2 pi I omega times x. So here's a strategy. I have my eigenvector psi. I prepare a bunch of control bits in 0 plus 1. And I do u to the 2 to the n minus 1. Right? And kick back a phase of e to the 2 pi 2 to the n minus 1 omega. I do a controlled u to the 2 to the n minus 2. Gives me a relative phase of e to the 2 to the n minus 1 omega, and so on. E to the 2 pi 2 omega and e to the 2 pi omega. So now I have all the bits I need. This bit, you know, again, x1, the leading bit of omega is most prominent. Here x1 is deleted, but this x2 is the most prominent, and so on. And we just learned that the quantum Fourier transform takes such a string of bits and extracts a really good estimator for omega. So that these strings interpreted in binary are a really good guess at omega. So eigenvalue estimation. Now I should say this wasn't Kataev's phase estimation algorithm. He had a sort of ad hoc phase estimation algorithm that repeated each of these separately and did some classical post-processing, which was very Fourier transform-like. This was our version with the quantum Fourier transform. Depends what you want to do. His might be more efficient. It's more tolerant to errors and doesn't require coherent operations. Though you can also make the Fourier transform not require, you can make these controlled rotations as well. Okay. But there might be robustness advantages to Kataev's original approach. But anyway, for understanding the algorithm, here's a simple way to do it. You prepare a superposition of all these n-bit strings, 3-bit strings. You kick back these phases, and then use the quantum Fourier transform to estimate those phases, which correspond to the eigenvalues. So conceptually, you can think of this as, you know, this is an inverse quantum Fourier transform. And one way to prepare those 0 plus 1s is to do the quantum Fourier transform. Of course, in practice, you wouldn't bother with those phase gates. But mathematically, what we're trying to show here is, and in the middle, the controlled u squared, that's how we exponentiate on a classical, that's how we exponentiate classically. Right? If you want to multiply by, if you want to compute 2 to the anything, it's called the square and multiply algorithm. Right? You represent x in binary. So it's 2 to the n minus 1, x1, plus 2 to the n minus 2, x2, and so on, plus 2x n minus 1 plus xn. If you want to compute, let's just forget about unitaries. You want to compute a to the x. Well, that's just a to the xn times a squared to the xn minus 1 times a to the 4th to the xn minus 2, etc., right? A to the 2 to the n minus 1 to the x1, right? It's a product of these numbers. So I wouldn't take a times a times a times a times a x times, okay? That would take forever. If n is big, that's 2 to the n steps. What we do is we take a, you know, we start with 1, right? We have a register with the number 1 in it. And then if x1 is 1, you multiply by A, right? This is, you multiply by A if x1 is 1, right? And you don't. You just leave it alone if x1 is 0. And then you square A. You square it. You get A squared. And then if xn minus 1 is 1, you multiply your working product by this number, by A squared. If it isn't, that's fine, because you need A squared. Square it again, you get A to the fourth. And then if xn minus 1 is 1, you multiply by A to the fourth. So it's a bunch of controlled multiplications by powers of A. Right? So these x's determine whether or not this x tells you whether you multiply by A. This xn minus 1 tells you whether you bother multiplying by A squared, and so on. This is the same algorithm we have here, except instead of multiplying by an integer A, you're multiplying by a unitary u. U squared, u to the fourth, and so on. So this is just an exponentiation circuit that takes an n-bit string encoding x and multiplies by u to the x. So what this eigenvalue estimation algorithm does is it takes a circuit for exponentiation and looks at it in a quantum Fourier transform basis. But classically, you don't know how to do that efficiently. But a quantum computer lets you take this essentially easy classical algorithm, depends what u is, but u could be simply multiplied by a. We know how to do that classically. We know how to exponentiate classically, not a big deal. But what a quantum computer is doing is it lets you look at it in a Fourier transform basis, a completely different basis that is just not easy to probe on a classical device. So if you have a u with eigenvector psi and eigenvalue e to the 2 pi omega, we have a method, we have an algorithm. If you sum all that up, that takes, you know, an initial register with a bunch of zeros in it, tensor the eigenvector, and spits out an estimator for the eigenvalue of psi. Now, a unitary will have, on a Hilbert space of dimension 2 to the n, we'll have 2 to the n eigenvectors, right? So this will have many eigenvectors, psi k, with different, potentially different eigenvalues, e to the 2 pi omega k, right? It'll map, again, it'll compute an estimator. Given psi k, it'll compute an estimator for omega k. So if you put in an arbitrary pure state in the second register, it has some decomposition in the eigenbasis. You don't have to know what it is, but it exists, right? So you have a superposition over alpha k, zero tensor eigenvector psi k. And then the eigenvalue estimation algorithm computes in superposition estimator for omega k, tensor psi k. And if you measure the first register of this, it's as if you trace out the second register, it's an orthonormal basis. So it's as if you're measuring, it's as if you were handed omega k tilde with probability alpha k squared. So let me give you an example now, which leads to the factoring algorithm. So suppose you have a group, which leads to the factoring algorithm. Not there yet, but close. Suppose you have a group G, and you want to find the order of some element in G. So the order is the smallest positive integer r such that a to the r is 1. Now you know how to multiply in that group, say. So using the methods I believe Richard would have sketched to you, we know how to map strings encoding x to strings encoding ax. Let's call that ua. So ua is a unitary such that when you raise it to the power of r, that's like multiplying by AR times, which is like multiplying by A to the R, which is 1. So multiplying by 1 is the identity. So UA is a unitary that is an Rth root of the identity. So right, I know what UA is. It takes strings, maps them to some other strings. And I know if I repeat it R times, I have implemented the identity. That means UA is the Rth root of identity. So what must its eigenvalues be? Rth roots of unity. Okay? We want R, remember? I can't get you R, but I can get you this. An eigenvalue estimation will estimate that for you with pretty good precision. Now, as an aside, When we say controlled you, we're not literally talking about a superposition of doing nothing or a superposition of running all your classical control to implement you. What we're talking about is taking your circuit for implementing you and doing a controlled gate, controlled G for every G in that circuit. So if this is a Hadamard, you replace this with a controlled Hadamard, a controlled knot, and a controlled Hadamard. And logically, these two are the same. And then you would recompile these gates into your available gate set. So it's at the logical level that we would do a controlled U. We're not at the physical layer saying whatever process it is that does U, do that in superposition or not, because that would be essentially impossible to isolate from the environment. Anyway, so there's an easy recipe for doing a controlled U given U. And you know, these relative phase shifts of E to the, you know, we want to do, you know, eigenvalue estimation here, obviously. How do we get the higher order powers of E to the 2 pi I k over R? I don't want to multiply by A 2 to the Y times, right? Like that's going to take me an exponential amount of time. But because in this case, we have a group operation, we can classically offline compute A squared, A to the 2 to the N minus 1, and so on, and just synthesize a unitary for multiplying by these elements. Okay, so we're just going to do, you know, square and multiply for computing these high powers of A. So we don't have to get these high order powers, repeat that unitary. So basically we can plug this into the eigenvalue estimation algorithm. Right. If I were to give you an eigenvector with eigenvalue e to the 2 pi I k over r, the eigenvalue estimation will give you a really good estimate of k over r. Now, I believe some of you asked Richard last time how this relates to factoring. Well, first of all, it's important because RSA cryptography is based on this problem and you use it every day. If you connect to the internet, you're using RSA, almost certainly, unless you happen to be using elliptic curve crypto, but quantum computers will break that too. And factoring reduces to this problem of finding the order of an integer modulo n, and I believe Richard sketched almost all the factoring algorithms we use today, even classical ones, are all about finding x and a y such that x squared is y squared, because then n divides x squared, x is y squared mod n. N will divide x squared minus y squared, and then difference of squares. That means some of the factors of n are inside x minus y, some will be inside x plus y. You hope they're not all in one or the other. There's a constant probability that this will split. So when you compute the GCD of n and x minus y and n and x plus y, you're very likely to split n into two factors. So order finding, if you pick an A of even order, then let x be the square root of, you know, A to the R over 2. You know R, it's even. So instead of A to the R, which is 1, let x be A to the R over 2. X squared is equal to 1 squared. So you have your difference of squares, and you can compute your GCDs. So that's just a quick sketch of how order finding, factoring reduces to order finding. Order finding reduces to eigenvalue estimation. Right. So we know how to do this. I'm going to skip this part. So we know how to efficiently map x to f at x. Again, the eigenvalues of ua are rth roots of unity. Yeah, I'll just sketch them here. So just we even know what they are. So if you plug in the eigenvalue estimation algorithm and you give me a really good estimate of k over r, you pick your precision parameter, your 2 to the n, so that it's definitely bigger than 2r squared, 1 over 2r. So 2 to the n is bigger than 2 times r squared. So it doesn't have to be that big. Little n doesn't have to be so big. Continued fractions will determine the fraction k over r for you. Now you might be worried, but what if k and r aren't co-prime? So you could just not worry about it, or you could just do this twice and then take the greatest common multiple, sorry, the least common multiple of your denominators, have a constant probability of being R. So that's very simple, classical post-processing undergraduate number theory. The key, the hard part is using the quantum computer to estimate K over R with high precision. Then the rest is simple number theory. And to summarize, the best rigorous classical algorithms use time exponential in square root n log n, log log n. Square root log n, log log n. In practice, there's good heuristics, but they still take time that's exponential in something polynomial in the logarithm. So these are called sub-exponential, but they're still pretty bad. Okay, these are infeasible for n, capital N being a 4,000-bit number. This is beyond, we can't do this. Whereas the quantum algorithm uses something that is polynomial in log n. Well, it's a game changer for solving these problems. And again, we probably wouldn't have cared if it weren't for the fact that our whole cybersecurity infrastructure, at least the public key part, is based on the difficulty of factoring, or another problem known as discrete logs, which quantum computers also solve. Okay. So I'm going to switch for the last few minutes and just give more of a high-level summary of what else quantum computers can do. So we've gone a little bit into the guts of some of the most important algorithms. But what else can they do? So factoring exponential speed up over the best known algorithms, in a black box setting, it's provable exponential speed up. And in fact, Shor came up with his essentially period finding algorithm after he saw Simon's method. Of course, had many non-trivial elements to it to get this order finding algorithm. Searching is one where there's only a quadratic speed up. Okay, there's no exponential speed up. But quadratic in practice can be quite substantial, very important. So the problem is, very simply, you have some function which maps n-bit strings to 0 or 1. Think of it as f at x is 1 if x is good, f at x is 0 if f at x is bad. You have a way of recognizing the strings you're looking for. So you don't know how to find it, but you can recognize it when you see it, like the solution to your equations, okay, a proof of your theorem. You can check it, but finding it, I don't know how to find it. Often it can take forever. But if somebody gives you the answer, let f be the algorithm that checks it for you. So we have a way of computing f. You want to find an x such that f at x is 1. It's a very generic search problem. So you maybe want to solve a three-sat formula. So phi is the and of a bunch of m clauses. Each clause is the or of three literals. So these y's are either let x1, x2, up to xn just be Boolean variables, and they're opposites. So the opposite of x1, opposite of x2, or the opposite of xn. And cj is true if either yj1 or yj2 or yj3, that should be a 3, are true. And phi is true if every clause is true. So within the clause, it's ors. Any one of these three bits being true would make cj true. But I need every clause to be true. I need c1 and c2. These, the upside down wedge is and. The v-shaped wedge is or. So it's a very classic problem in computer science. This is one of the classic NP-hard problems. Give me an assignment, I can easily check the clauses to see if they're all true. So it's very easy to check if phi is true. So it's very easy to compute f sub phi of x, which says, tell me 1 if x satisfies the formula and 0 otherwise. And finding such an x is a classic NP-hard problem. Finding the ground state of an Ising spin system. Okay. Under the right conditions, that's NP hard. It's easy to check the answer, super hard to find it. Now, what we all tried was, of course, let's prepare a uniform superposition of everything. Okay? And notice we have the answer not with just with probability 1 over 2 to the n, we have it with amplitude 1 over root 2 to the n. And then we have all this junk that we don't want. with the rest of the amplitude. What if there were a way to keep the good stuff, and for the bad stuff, we'll re-scramble it, somehow replace with another uniform sampling, give me another 1 over root 2 to the n amplitude, and add that to my pile of good stuff. Right? That's kind of what we wanted to do, and people would look at you and say, yeah, how do you do that? How do you do that unitarily? Because why would you want to do that? Because then you only have to do that square root of 2 to the n times before you get an amplitude on the good state w that is close to 1. Right? Now classically, if I have an algorithm that samples, here we're going to assume there's only one solution w. I don't know if I called it omega before, but here let's call this w. There's only one solution for simplicity. I have a chance of 1 and 2 to the n of guessing it. Classically, I have to repeat 2 to the n times roughly before I have a high probability of finding it. But there's a hope that maybe on a quantum device, we only have to query square root of 2 to the n times. That'd be a big deal in some cases. Of course, this is hard to do unitarily, but Lov Grover found a way. He was at AT&T Bell Labs. He said, look at a superposition that imagine lining up all the n-bit strings here and drawing their amplitude. So uniformly sample all the n-bit strings. There's omega. That's the one you're looking for. Good luck. That's just a Hadamard gate, n-bit Hadamard applied to n-bits. When you apply the oracle that puts a minus sign in front of the good string, the average value of these amplitudes goes down. I have no idea why he thought of this. But the average value goes down. And then he came up with this operation called inversion about the mean, which he meant was, here, my amplitude is right here. Invert about the mean, so it flips down here. Take this amplitude and reduce it to here. This amplitude, reduce it to here. So flip it around this red line. And this amplitude flips way up here now. That was his idea. I don't know where it came from, but this is the net effect. So that was where the mean was. Inverts about the mean. Turns out that's unitary. And he gave a really simple circuit for implementing it. And the idea is you just keep repeating this. And I don't have time to go over it, but that mean, that W that you're looking for, every time you do these two reflections, it keeps increasing by roughly 2 times 1 over square root 2 to the n, roughly. So when you repeat this 2 to the n times, its amplitude is really close to 1. If you keep going, it starts shrinking again. But it builds up to root. So this is this idea of starting with the superposition of everything, flipping about the solution state, then doing that weird inversion about the mean. If you keep repeating that, repeat this, flip the good state, invert about the mean. Flip the good state, invert about the mean. This slowly grows more and more and more. So at the end of the day, you have, and my friends, my colleagues, Boyer, Broussard, Hoyer, and Tapp, analyzed this very carefully and noticed that the amplitude Grover proved that it goes close to 1, that it gets large. They came up with a precise form that says, what you get is sine 2k plus 1 theta. So let sine theta be your original amplitude of omega. So sine theta is square root 1 over 2 to the n. After k iterations of Grover's iterate, you have amplitude sine 2k plus 1 theta of the good stuff and cos 2k plus 1 theta of all the bad states you don't want. So, if you know what theta is, if you know what sine theta is, you know what theta is, you know what k should be. Right? You want sine 2k plus 1 theta to be close to 1, so it's easy to calculate. You want k to be roughly square root of 2 to the n, right? Times pi over 4, say. That's if you want to be close to 1. So you get a square root speed up. Now, if you have a different algorithm where you don't know the probability of success, you do have an issue in terms of not knowing when to stop if you don't know theta. But computer scientists have a very easy fix for that, which I won't get into. So you can generalize this to any algorithm. Consider any algorithm that produces some superposition where the, let psi 1 be a renormalized superposition of the good states, psi 0 a renormalized superposition of the bad states. And you know, alpha a 0 is sine theta something good plus cos theta something bad. And without loss of generality, you can always do that, because sine squared theta plus cos squared theta is 1. And the same algorithm, essentially. So you have a success probability of p equals sine squared theta. Classically, you have to repeat 1 over p times. And you have something which works with probability p. And with one shot, repeat 1 over p times, you have probability close to 1. But this Grover's algorithm, generalized as Boyer, Broussard, Hoyer, and Tapp did, repeat it k times, you get the same sinusoidal behavior, same square root speed up. So the number of iterations is now not 1 over p, but 1 over square root of p. So it speeds up any heuristic quadratically. So there's a potential for speeding up almost any optimization algorithm. In practice, the hard part is, classically, there's often some very nice heuristic that is not a naive, just keeps it guessing until you find one. So we often have a hard time outperforming heuristics, serial heuristics. But so we look for problems where the best known algorithms are essentially brute force exhaustive search. We can speed those up quadratically. We can also, I won't get into it, we can also, if you look at the eigenvectors, eigenvalues of the Grover iterate, you realize they give us clues, right? If you want to know what is the probability of success for this operator A, there's also, you can use eigenvalue estimation to do that. So you can also use it for counting, for example, or computing integrals. Counting is related to computing averages, which is essentially what an integral is. Integral is just the average value of a function over a range times the length of the range, right? So you can use this for computing integrals. I'm just going to very quickly state and then sketch that, you know, there's still people out there say there's only two quantum algorithms, Shor and Grover. That's just not true. In the early years, in the 90s, yeah, we spent a lot of time understanding these, analyzing them, generalizing them. And you could argue that with the exception of the Hamiltonian simulation, which is a really important algorithm, which existed was a precursor of all of this. I mean, at least Feynman sketched the idea, and then people like Lloyd and Zalka and others worked it out in more detail. So there's Hamiltonian simulation. They're already forgetting one algorithm, Hamiltonian simulation. Then Shor-type algorithms, which is a huge family of algorithms, which we generalized as well. Grover-type algorithms, but there's many more. So we did, first of all, we generalized the hidden subgroup framework. There is an umbrella problem that encompasses all of these. I'll give you these notes. It's also sketched. Most of this is in our book. One cool application of the hidden subgroup paradigm, hidden subgroup problem, which generalizes Shor's order finding algorithm, is we know in mathematics that if you give me a finite abelian group, any finite abelian group can be decomposed as a direct sum of finite cyclic groups. But finding that decomposition is in general hard, right? If you could decompose the multiplicative group of integers modulo n, you can factor n, right? So we wouldn't be basing security of the internet on it if it were easy. So this in general, there's no magic box for doing it. But quantum algorithms will, by the hidden subgroup algorithm, find this decomposition for you. It'll find those generators. We've looked at non-abelian groups, such as the symmetric group. If you could solve the hidden subgroup problem for the symmetric group, you could solve the graph isomorphism problem. Now, recently, people have shown that these problems are quasi-polynomial. But still, this remains for a quantum computer. We haven't yet been successful in finding a nice quantum algorithm. So there's the Hamiltonian simulation algorithm, which is perhaps going to be the first killer app of scalable quantum computers. Perhaps. We'll see. You know, there's all sorts of approaches for quantum supremacy. I think this one, on a fault-tolerant device, will certainly outlive the utility, I think, will be, in the longer term, one of the most useful applications. So the problem here is you're given a Hamiltonian, which is a sum of very simple Hamiltonians, like local Hamiltonians. So you know how to simulate e to the I hk, you know, delta t. And you assume you have a way to prepare the starting state you want, you're interested in. You have some tolerance, delta. You don't need the perfect answer. You just want to be within delta of the correct answer. And there's some time period tf. So you want to know some property of this of a system that starts in state psi 0, evolves for time tf, right? So within delta, you want to know some property. And that's sort of the problem, the quantum computer. So what a quantum computer can do is create a state that is really close to what this starting state would have evolved to under the evolution of the time-independent Hamiltonian h for time tf. Yeah, really close, within delta. And it runs in time polynomial in the number of terms in the Hamiltonian and the 1 over delta parameter. This has actually been improved in recent years by many of my colleagues at Waterloo and elsewhere. But it's a classic algorithm that is people are starting to dig in more deeply and apply it to specific systems.
Sorry.
I'll stop here. Yeah?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Wasn't from the thing using that algorithm and actually just doing
the experiment? So you have to actually do the experiment. And you might not, the experiment might not lend itself to, you know, probing, you know, measuring a specific bit or applying some, let's measure it in some weird basis. Like your experimental apparatus doesn't always allow that, right? Sometimes you can rotate your polarizing filter and measure in a range of bases, but often what you can naturally measure is, you can measure the energy, the which orbital it's in, or there's certain things you can measure, but you can't, in your real physical system, you don't have as many knobs you can turn, is one thing. Whereas when you're simulating it, you can do all sorts of weird transformations that mathematically are possible, but physically don't know how to do them. So that you can turn more knobs and probe more things. Also, it's not always easy. Like, I mean, you can simulate things that don't exist yet. It might take you billions of dollars to build these, you know, construct these materials with this specific parameter. And then you're like, okay, that didn't work. What if I tweaked that parameter and made it a little, you know, 1% bigger? Okay, we'll just go back and fabricate. You know, it could be very expensive and time-consuming, maybe even dangerous, to simulate. To do all these different experimental runs. So, I mean, this is why we simulate things classically today. I mean, so I do think you, at some point, you do want to go to the lab and try it often, but it helps a lot in designing which experiments you want to do, which materials you want to build, to just, if you could scan through, you know, trillions of different configurations before, and then to find one that maybe is superconducting at a high temperature, and then go build, synthesize that material versus going to a lab and synthesizing trillions of different materials and testing them. It just, there's a cost advantage in a sense.
You're using one quantum system to simulate.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's lots, I think, practical advantages. It's a good question. Because if you knew that, no, this is the one thing I care about, there's no tweaking of parameters, I know exactly what I want to simulate, then yeah, maybe you could just... But even with nuclear weapons, when they were designed in the 40s, you know, there was a lot of simulations before they went and tried things. And, you know, I'm sure they did many tests of different parts of it. But there was a lot of simulations as well. You had a question?
Yes, I think it's quick, and it might be a bit naive, but with this sort of, like, Hamiltonian constructions, you can only construct things that are sort of, like, polynomial in like quantum complexity, right? I mean, but kind of by definition of how you can do.
Where the complexity of the Hamiltonian itself is polynomial.
Yes.
Yes.
My question. Okay.
Yeah.
So,
but I think that's typically the way the real world works, right? not necessarily,
yes.
But you know, if there's well-identified subsystems, interactions tend to be local, and I mean, if nature, like, here's a challenge. If nature truly violates these principles in a meaningful way, where you can't simulate it in polytime on a quantum computer, you can start violating some complexity theory assumptions in quantum computation. And that could be a testable thing. So I don't think it works. Whatever you're dreaming of, I'm going to prove me wrong, please, because that would be really, really exciting. But we believe in what's called the strong Church Turing thesis, which says that if you can build it in a lab, we should be able to simulate it with polynomial overhead on a quantum computer. Now, that polynomial overhead could be, n to the 20, in which case it's not practical. But at least in theory, with that warning aside, which is non-trivial, we believe that anything you could really synthesize and exploit in a scalable way in the lab, there is an efficient quantum simulation for it.
Isn't that just like the whole classical to quantum transition all over again? Like, we have classical computers, we want to simulate quantum things, and that doesn't work very well, so we just use quantum things instead. If you find something that's not simulatable on a quantum computer, that's like a specific new material, can you just build a new computer out of that material?
Yeah, so the thesis is, so David Deutsch's idea in the 80s was, for any physical paradigm, any theory of framework for physics, there is a computing model that captures the computational power of that paradigm. So we believe the quantum computer, as we've defined it, captures the computing power of the quantum mechanical world we live in. So one of two things. We're wrong. There's another computing device, same physical paradigm, but that fully captures the power of this physical paradigm as we understand it. Because it's a thesis, not a theorem. You could try to prove the theorem, but inevitably there'll be some assumptions that we might be making, and then maybe there's a way to wiggle around those assumptions. Or we're in a richer physical reality than we've previously understood, so there's a new paradigm in a sense, and we need a new computing model that captures it. And it may be that this new computing model is more powerful, and that would be great, I think. Okay, I'll stop here and just wrap this up on Thursday and then do some... Are you interested in cybersecurity? I can talk about algorithms forever, but just to give you a flavor of another really interesting problem in quantum information.
I think the cybersecurity would be cool.
Yeah, and I won't get... I mean, I really drag you through the guts of some of how some of these quantum algorithms work in the beginning. The cybersecurity stuff, I think, will... be more of an overview. Okay, so I'll see you on Thursday.
Thanks.